Tom Woods Show, episode 907.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am playing for you today my appearance on The Tatiana Show, which is the podcast hosted by Tatiana Moroz. She was a guest on this show back on episode 882, and this year she will be once again a guest aboard the Contra Cruise, which you can find out about at ContraCruise.com. Today, in our chat that I'm playing for you, we cover a wide range of topics, anything from Donald Trump to libertarian theory to personal details about me you may wish you didn't know about, all kinds of fun stuff coming up in this conversation. If you would like to know more about Tatiana, you can check out her website at TatianaMoroz.com. That's M-O-R-O-Z. All right, here's the episode. I hope you like it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Tatiana Show. You're very lucky this week because you're getting not one, but two Tatiana shows for the price of zero, because I'm not charging you for these episodes. But yesterday we had Amir Taki on. That was kind of really interesting. We had Lynn Ulbricht on. And today on May 2nd, we have Tom Woods. And Tom and I have known each other for a while now. We've been involved in liberty movement. And I remember when I first got involved, everybody would say, oh, it's Tom Woods. And I was thinking, why is everybody so excited? But then when I heard him speak, I knew why. And Tom is a great way of explaining all sorts of bits of information. And, you know, some of the questions that I had when I came from maybe a little bit more of a liberal position into a libertarian position were helped to be clarified with Tom's stuff. So, Tom, thank you very much for joining us on the Tatiana Show today. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Tatiana. Very glad to be here.
Great. So how do you get your qualifications? How did you get to be so knowledgeable about so many different things?
Well, sort of in spite of my formal education, I suppose you could say, even though on paper, you know, I've got a pretty good resume. I went to elite universities. I went to Harvard and Columbia. I got a PhD in history. But although I wouldn't say, I think it would be silly to say I didn't learn anything at all when I was there. I learned a lot of stuff when I was there. But on the other hand, a lot of stuff I had to learn on my own, or I had to ask people I trusted, what are some good books on these subjects? And the nice thing about being at one of these universities is that in those days when you had to get old-fashioned books, they had all the books. And secondly, since almost nobody else on campus thought the way I did, those books were never checked out by anyone. So I could get the books I was interested in. They were always right there on the shelf. They hadn't been checked out in 50 years or whatever. Or I would go and, you know, years later, I would go and take out a book and I would say, boy, this book hasn't been taken out for 15 years. And then I'd look and, yeah, the last person who took it out 15 years ago was me. So, I mean, no other interest. So it was right there that I realized that even at these top universities, you can learn a lot of facts, you can learn names and dates, but they're going to leave out a lot, or they're going to leave out certain schools of thought, certain interpretations that are not approved, that are not establishment approved. And so that became sort of my shtick, that I would be the guy who would go out and retell the story of America without the establishment slant.
So what do you think that establishment slant, where do you see that being most prevalent? And how is that coordinated? Do you think that it's because of public schooling and sort of indoctrination through public schooling? Or what do you think is the way that they kind of get everybody to agree to it? Is there, you know, two guys that are allowed to write the history books, everybody else to the back of the line? How does that work?
Well, I think in practice what happens is that local school boards wind up approving the textbooks. And these school boards tend, in general, to be composed of people who think a certain way. So if I wrote a textbook, there's no way it would get approved. So that is a barrier to the introduction of different ideas. So instead, we get the same kind of narrative, which is that everybody knows that it's stupid and backward to have, let's say, a decentralized government, you know, where you have localities and counties and states, and they all have their different responsibilities and make decisions. We all know that's backward and stupid, and that even forward-looking is to have a centralized system where in Washington, people who are your betters, people who are experts, people who are qualified to make decisions for you are running the show and are in charge, and you know, you peons should be grateful to be ruled over by us. And then related to that is that we all know that a free market economy is probably kind of stupid too. Instead, it's better if we have experts who know what's better for you to be managing the economy. So there, these sorts of stories get told over and over and over again. And there might be one glimmer of truth here and there, and then they pervert it into a tissue of falsehoods. And I just, I'm there to set fire to that tissue of falsehoods.
Let that tissue burn.
So you've actually also, I guess, okay.
So when you talk about absorbing information, right? I was thinking you've also learned a lot because of your show. How many episodes have you done so far? I mean, you essentially have built yourself a life where you can interview anybody you think that's interesting and ask them whatever you want. So I would think that that was even more valuable than the library classes.
Yeah, this is crazy. It's over 900 episodes now of the Tom Woods Show. And I'm actually planning right now a big in-person, on-stage, live event for the 1,000th episode. I'm going to fly some special guests in. We're just going to have a huge blowout occasion on that day. But yeah, of course, I exploit this situation. I think to myself, I'll read a book and I'll say, I wish I could ask this person the following few things. And then I think, wait a minute, I'm a podcast host. I can ask this person. But instead of bothering the person with some emails that might never get answered, I say, why, how would you like to appear on my show? And then the person gets on the show. And then I selfishly ask all the questions I want. So that is that's definitely a lot of fun. And what's interesting about it is that you get more yeses than you think you'll get when you invite people onto your show. My friend Scott Horton has a foreign policy show from a libertarian perspective, and he's had all kinds of top-level people on his show. I say, how did you get so-and-so on? And the answer is, I asked. And a lot of the time, people just say, yeah, sure. I mean, I will be glad to leverage your audience to get my message out, is the attitude a lot of people have. So I've been able to have everybody from Ralph Nader to Ron Paul on the show, with the wrestler Kane added in for good measure along the way. And it's been a ton of fun.
Did you ever have any surprises happen? What was the most shocking episode?
Oh, gee, that's the kind of question I wish I had prepared for, because surely there was one. Yeah, I would say probably the very beginning of my episode 897 with just a few days ago with Thad Russell. And I can't repeat
Who's
what it was.
Who's Thad Russell?
Said. He's a historian.
This is a terrible story. You can't even tell us.
No, he's a historian I knew. We met each other briefly. We were both getting our PhDs at Columbia, but we didn't really know each other then. And at that time, we weren't really ready to know each other. Like, he was more hardcore on the left, and I was more hardcore on the right, and we would have just not gotten along. But now we kind of realize that whole thing's just annoying. You know, that just doesn't shed a lot of light these days. And we've both evolved a bit in our thinking. So now we just really like each other. We haven't seen each other since. But he was talking about his brand new podcast, and he started talking about some of the guests, and it was like people in the people in prostitution, and I'm all for
edgy guests,
right? And and I'm a little square. There's nothing wrong with being square, but I'm kind of square. And I thought, I wonder if he really gets where I'm coming from. But I think he just wants to nudge me a little bit. Yeah, that's okay. I could take it.
He's but, trying to shake it up a little.
No, all I can say is, when you do 900 of anything, there are going to be a few turkeys. And I just leave it to the listeners to take a wild guess at what those are. But what amazes me is that you could have somebody on your show who's giving you one-word answers. I mean, how could you possibly think I invited you on for one-word answers? How could you possibly think that's what I want? And so these are people, like, I'm sweating bullets trying to get something out of these people. Then I got to just send them away and never speak to them again.
That's really funny. I've been doing this. I don't even know how many episodes we have. I should probably count them, of the Tatiana Show. And once in a while, I do get folksy. It's a little bit like pulling teeth. And sometimes people just freeze up when they're talking to somebody on the radio or on camera. And I have a friend, not at all a political friend or anything, but she is hilarious in person. And she did a reality show, just died, just was the worst one on the show. So I don't know. Sometimes people choke up.
Well, I'll say I had some unusual things happen. Let's say I had somebody on, Carlos Morales, who used to be with Child Protective Services. And now he's a whistleblower about them. He says, these people, they sound great. We think, well, who's against protecting children, right? But in reality, he says, they're doing more harm than good. And I asked him just point blank, do you feel like you yourself, looking back on what you personally did, do you have any regrets? Do you feel like I wrecked that family or I did these terrible things? And he was very frank and open admitting things on the show. And I do get that from time to time where it's, wow, I'm really grateful that somebody was willing to be that open. And then even I on the show a couple of times, sometimes I run episodes that are me being on other people's podcasts. And I think, you know, I do 5 episodes a week. Sometimes I'm lazy. I think, good, I'll just use that as one of my episodes. Great. And of course, you realize, Tatiana, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, Tatiana show would make a good episode of the Tom Wood show one of these days. But anyway, I'll ask you about that later. But I was talking to Isaac Morehouse. Do you know him with Praxis?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, you'd love this guy. Totally love this guy. He's got this thing called Praxis. And the idea of it is that instead of putting kids through the university / unemployment axis, instead, mm-hmm. axis of evil, instead, you give them an opportunity to work with, let's say, a startup company or to do an apprenticeship and really get hands-on experience. And then you get out of there and they guarantee you a job earning at least $40,000 a year. And the average offer that their graduates are getting is $55,000 a year. And they're starting at age 19. And now they're going to get 3 years of experience over their peers. It's an amazing thing. Anyway, Isaac had for a while the Isaac Morehouse podcast, and I went on there, and I just thought we'd talk about history and things I do and entrepreneurship. To that, I ended up like spilling my guts about all my insecurities in my life, you know, let's say that was a bit of a surprise that the conversation took that road, because I told him the story of how, when I was in junior high school, I was just miserable. And I have kids who are junior high age now, and I know the angst that they're experiencing, but I just did not connect with these other kids on any level at all. Just couldn't.
You're the weirdo.
I was the weirdo because I cared about things. Like I wanted to avoid nuclear war, things, you know, trivial things like that. I was concerned about that. Ah, come on.
Why not Ninja Turtles, Tom?
Exactly. I don't understand. Let's throw the football around, which, by the way, I also did from time to time. Well, anyway, it was really bad. They made my life miserable. It was terrible. Now, by the time I got to high school, I started to kind of get out of that. Partly because I really worked on my sense of humor. I thought, you know, if they just saw how funny I was, maybe people would want to like me. And sure enough, they did. They'd say, okay, he's a little dorky. He's the captain of the math team, but he's so doggone funny. I can't not hang around with him. Well, anyway, though, all the way up till I was in my early 40s. So we're talking about just a couple of years ago. From that moment all the way up to a couple of years ago, I would not let go of my hatred and resentment of those people. I mean, it tormented me constantly. I just could not get over with what they had done to me. And so I would go through my life, every little victory I had, I would kind of think to myself, you know, that ought to, you know, stick in their craw. You know, like I would be constantly thinking that, or I'd get a new car and I'd think, yeah, what kind of car are you driving? I mean, just awful, right? Really, really petty and childish and terrible. And it was just eating away at my soul. Like spiritually, that's not any good
way. Sure, it's not healthy for you.
So I even told the story of how I went to my 25-year reunion 2 years ago, and I walked through those doors. And of course, I had a lot of friends. You know, high school was better, but some of the tormentors were there. And I actually went right up to them and started up conversations. And it turned out, you know, some of these were okay people. And in fact, one of them, his child had had cancer and they had battled it in the hospital for like a year. And it was just awful. And I thought, if that happened to one of my girls, I don't think I'd make it. It would just absolutely kill me. So the first thing I did, I walked right by all my ordinary friends. I went right up to this guy and I said, I heard about what happened to your daughter. That's just terrible. Nobody should have to go through that. And this just opened doors just on a human level that I did that. And I approached him. And by the end of the night, it was like, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. Everything is all cleared up and everything's straightened up. And they were all saying nice. They're all saying things like, we heard you're doing really well. And that's just great. You know, we're really proud you're doing so well. And I thought, I have finally closed that door. I've closed that chapter in my life. So yeah, that came out on my podcast was a little surprising.
Yeah. Well, you know what, those things, I mean, you know, there's the bully police, right? And there's something to be said for toughening up kids and not giving everybody the participation trophy because it's kind of silly and it's not necessarily good either. But yeah, I think kids can be really cruel. I remember when I was in elementary school and middle school, I was pretty dorky. I remember these girls, they were throwing Jolly Ranchers at my hair. But then high school, for some weird reason, I became, you know, not a dork. And I looked exactly the same. There was nothing different. But it was hard, I think. You know, everybody wants to be accepted. And I'm sure it's difficult seeing children going through that. Do you homeschool your kids or no? You send them off to be tortured?
Well, for a while, we sent them to a really excellent private school. I mean, I know this is going to sound weird when I put it this way, but this is a school that would invite me in to speak. Now, I don't mean that because I'm so awesome, that makes it great. I mean that I'm so weird, that makes it great, right?
Compared to what
students would normally be hearing. Because they had this, in the high school level, they had this great ideas course. And when they would get to 19th century classical liberalism or libertarianism, they would have me come in and teach it year after year. And man, I was getting away with murder in there. In fact, I recorded my appearance in that classroom and I made that into an episode of my show. I think I called it something like What I Told the 11th Graders About Liberty. So that was great. But then we've moved to Florida and it's kind of slim pickings here. So it seems likely that we are indeed going to wind up going the homeschooling route. I mean, my view is that as with anything, if you're in a situation where if you have a really good school, then you might as well go ahead and use it. But because in the same way, I don't do all my own plumbing or carpentry, I hire people for that. Same thing with educating. But I think we'll probably wind up going that route. But my kids are naturally curious anyway. No matter what their setting is, they come home and they ask me a lot of questions. And I don't try to go out of my way to sit them down and say, now here's the lesson on inflation. And I don't do that. But if they ask me, then I give them my sincere answer. Or sometimes there'll be something on the news, on the radio or something, and I'll give them my commentary on it. And they trust me. They like having me as their dad. And so when I tell them stuff, they're inclined to believe it. So now they feel like, man, that federal government, what is it up to now? You know, what a bunch of jerks they are, you know.
That's very funny. I like the picturing of that.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about just in general, people... I grew up in New Jersey, and so we don't have a lot of homeschoolers that I know of necessarily. For me, when I first heard about homeschooling, I thought, oh, these weird kids, but really they seem very bright. And I went to Berkeley in Boston, the music school. And when I came back, I started hiring interns at the recording studio. And these kids would come in with a 4-year, even Berkeley, great school, blah, 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 which is now $200,000 for 4 years of school, which
insane.
Is bananas.
Insane.
And if they had just gone to the studio, the first year and a half of working in a studio, you're cleaning toilets the whole time anyway. You would have saved 200 grand. And yeah, I think that there's something to be said for getting the degree. It does open doors because of the name. But if you can establish that name brand recognition, like it seems like they're doing with these various programs, then maybe that kind of gives it its own flavor. Would you use the Ron Paul has a book series, right, for homeschooling? Is that what you would use?
Oh yeah, it's a video based curriculum from K through 12, and for the high school grades, I personally created 400 videos on history from the ancient Hebrews all the way up to the present. And it was, but my listeners would be tired of hearing me complaining about how much work it was. But let me tell you, that took 2 years here. And it was like nonstop work. So even when I was not so-called working, in my spare time, I was reading, because I wanted this to be if I'm going to do this and I have the possibility to reach a lot of young people, I want it to be the best I can possibly make it. I want this to be top notch. I want them to learn everything they can possibly learn. And it just really, really killed me. But yeah, I would like to use it because if you look, for example, at just the middle school science courses, they are so much more interesting than your boring, you know, let's plant some seeds in a cup of dirt and see what sprouts up. It is so much better. They've got units where they teach the kids about robotics and they show them how to assemble little robotic devices they can control, or how to build a radio, or how to be self-sufficient in the outdoors. In other words, things that, yeah, you learn the science, but you learn the practical application, which is what kids care about. Why am I learning all these formulas? Well, the answer is here's why. Here's what you do with the formulas. That's really the thing that I like about it. I think what people think of when they hear Ron Paul curriculum, they think, oh, it's going to be libertarians teaching libertarian economics. And sure, you know, there's going to be some free market economics in it. But what's great about it is all this other stuff. Like we have a course on personal finance for teens.
Now, this is
something adults need to learn. Yeah. right? Yeah. So they won't be in debt. They'll make better decisions. It's just a lot of stuff that you wouldn't get otherwise. So I have my own page for it. It's ronpaulhomeschool.com. And on my page, if you get the curriculum, I throw in all these extra bonuses because I'm that kind of guy.
You also have a Liberty Classroom, which I think is such a cool idea. I remember not Liberty Classroom, but when I first got into libertarian ideas and I became fan of Ron Paul, I watched The Money Masters, which is a pretty hefty video. It's, you know, 3.5 hours or something, and it's not the best production value. But that alone, I thought, could replace an entire grade of social studies. I mean, I think just wipe out junior year, make me watch a 3-hour movie, and that's way more useful maybe than 2 years of that. What do you guys cover in Liberty Classroom and how extensive is that course?
Yeah, I created that back in 2012 with because somebody gave me the idea. Here's how I came up with the idea, how I, quote unquote, came up with the idea. And by which, of course, I mean somebody completely different came up with the idea. I just ran with it because it was such a good one. For a while I used to be a professor. I used to work for 4 years. I was at the Mises Institute collecting a salary. But then after 2010, I have not collected a salary since then. I've been entirely on my own, generate my own income through various ways. And you got to figure out how to make a living online. I've become pretty good at that. Like, I've become really, really good at that. So one thing that I've done is this thing, create a product, because I want to create something that I think will genuinely help other people and that they'll feel like, yes, take my money. This is a fair transaction. You put a lot of effort into this. There's a lot of value there. So Liberty Classroom came about when a very wise marketing friend said to me, Tom, you know, you've built up a decent following because of your books and speeches and stuff. So how are you parlaying that into some kind of online income? And I said, well, I belong to the Amazon affiliate program. You know, that brings in like $20 a month. He's just shaking his head like, Woods, do I need to spell it out? Do I need to draw you a diagram? He said, think about what it is people are interested in that you do. And they're interested in when you get up there and you say, here's the phony history and here's the real history. What if you actually had full-fledged courses where you went through systematically through history and you said, here's the real story? And you bundle that into a product. And I thought, whoa, hey, that's pretty good. So I brought on a few other people, like Liberty Movement people who had PhDs. And I know PhD doesn't necessarily mean you're smart, but in this case, it did for those people. And I brought them on board. I said, let's do history and economics. And then later I asked my people, I love my dorky subscribers. I asked them, what new course would you like us to do? And they said logic. And I thought, what is wrong with you?
I thought of that. I like that too. I want to be able to fight people and destroy them with my logic.
All right. That's good. Well, that means, Tatiana, I mean this is a compliment. That means the old dorky Tatiana is still in there. Deep down is still in there.
That's awesome. Deeply down. She's
Well, anyway, so I hired somebody to do. I said, look, if that's what you people want, I'll give it to you. So at this point, we're about to add our 19th course. So we just keep adding courses every single year. And you don't have to, you know, it's not like we're teaching at 5:30 p.m. You just consume it anytime you want. That we recorded them all. And you can watch them. You can just listen to them as MP3s. You can use our app, which we just released last year.
For Android and Apple or is it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah, for the iPhone people who barely know how to use computers. Got it.
Oh, ouch. Ouch.
No, I'm talking about myself.
Okay. Yeah, I'm an Android person, but it doesn't matter. So I did. But then also we have these other benefits, like once a month we do a live event where I bring the faculty on and we take questions live. We got Q&A forums, all kinds of fun stuff like that. So yeah, I created that. It's at libertyclassroom.com. I don't want to overwhelm people with websites, but I actually give away a free course. So you can see, you know, if you don't like it, then that's okay. We can still be friends. But it's, can you believe the domain freehistorycourse.com was available? I bought that.
That's really funny.
It's the best 10 smackers I ever spent. Freehistorycourse.com. It's our course on the US presidents. And so you can see all the crumminess all throughout history.
So you were talking before about, stories where it's the fake story and the real story. And I'm assuming that not every audience is initiated. Is there, you know, some sort of a story that you tell that has the biggest impact that makes people who were full on government lovers all of a sudden really break through the I don't want to say the brainwash, but through the brainwash.
Yeah, no, sure, sure. Well, you know, it's the answer is yes. And yet it's so different for so many people, because for a lot of people, every person has a different stumbling block in a lot of cases. So, for example, foreign policy is a stumbling block that I had. And then you start talking to them about how well it's all worked out. And they say, well, yeah, I mean, you got to give them that. So with me, as a speaker, one of the things that I've noticed that people respond to is a story I tell about the chemical manufacturer Herbert Dow. I mean, this story actually gets gasps from the audience, so you know you're onto something. And okay. The long and the short of it is I'm talking about monopoly, because we're all supposed to fear like the 19th century. The mm-hmm. idea you get from your textbook is that the economy was run by short men with white mustaches running around wearing a monocle and carrying mm-hmm. sacks of money with a dollar sign written on it. And I'm trying to say that actually it's, you know, real history is a little less cartoonish than that. So I gave the example of Herbert Dow, who was this great chemical magnate in the early 20th century, and he would produce chemicals like bromine that you would use for sometimes for film developing and in dyes and whatever. And there was a German cartel that sold these chemicals in Europe, and he wanted to break into the European market, and they made clear no upstart Americans or anybody else for that matter is allowed to sell here. Only we can sell here. And he thought, well, there's no law that says that. I'm going to sell wherever I want to sell. So he wound up underselling them consistently. And they're selling it for 49 cents a pound. He's selling it for 36 cents. And so he literally gets a knock on his door. Like, this isn't just figurative, like he got a letter in the mail. He literally gets a knock on his door saying, I would knock that off if I were you. Well, he keeps on doing it. So then they think, all right, here's what we'll do. We will really stick it to him. We will way undersell bromine in the U.S. and we'll just break him. Because he had to make profits in the U.S. to really make up for, you know, what he was doing. Well, anyway, the point, long and the short of the story is this. He ignores all the threats. He keeps lowering his prices, and they respond by lowering prices of bromine in the U.S. So what he does is he buys their bromine in the U.S. because they're selling it lower than he can get it. So he starts buying it from them at their low price. And then he takes that and resells it in Europe. And they're saying, how? So they finally say, well, all right, we'll sell it at 15 cents a pound. So they keep on doing this. They get it down to 10 and a half cents. They say, this will crush him. He's buying it from them. And he goes over. And so, in other words, the old story is that what will happen is a monopolist will come by and he'll undersell all his competitors and then he'll be victorious. Well, this is exactly what they tried to do. But he figured, if I just buy it at their price and I sell it in Europe, they can't sell it in Europe and the U.S. for 10 and a half cents. So they finally realized, all right, we have to make some cuts, a deal with this guy. So you tell that kind of story, you realize, you know what? If businessmen are clever when it comes to creating so-called monopoly situations, other businesses are equally clever at coming up with ways around it. So, in other words, the economy is less cartoonish than we think. There are ways to get out from under this. Or we think of John D. Rockefeller, and he totally cornered the oil refinery market. But by the time the federal government got around to prosecuting him, his market share had gone down from like 85% to 25%, just naturally, because a bunch of other refiners popped up. So again, the idea that the government is the impartial bystander who will come along and rescue us, it just doesn't. A lot of times we wind up rescuing ourselves, or the problem isn't really a problem after all, or the government makes it worse, or the government winds up sanctioning the monopoly in the first place. So these sorts of ways of thinking get people open to new ideas, basically.
When you have, so when I run into people that I'm trying to convince them that less government is more, automatically everybody starts fighting about anarchy, and I'm not necessarily even advocating full-on anarchy. But one of the concerns that I think is a little bit hard to combat is, if you had, for example, the privatizing of the policing industry, right? So you had different options. How do you make sure that the rich people don't buy up all the good cops, and then the people who don't have much money are just stuck with the dregs, and they get attacked by the hard police forces that are bolstered by the financing of these rich people?
Right. Now, in this area, I'm not much of a theorist of. Mm-hmm. I mean, in principle, I'm in favor, but I don't really give it much thought. But I mean, my instinct would be to say, how different is that from what we have now? I mean, the rich people have gated communities. They have literal bars around their compounds. They have private guards. They have all the money, all the security money can buy. And what do the poor have? Well, a lot of times they're very unhappy with what they have. They're so unhappy that they're out protesting against their alleged protectors. Half the time, the alleged protectors turn out to be abusers. Now, if that were what happened on the free market, we'd never hear the end of it. We'd say, the free market. There it goes, oppressing the poor. But that is exactly what we have now. It's just like with education. Well, in a private system, the poor would have no options. That's exactly what's happening now. Exactly. The poor have rotten options.
And it costs after a lot. Case after case. They spend so much.
And they spend a fortune. Meanwhile, the reality is when you look at the work done by James Tooley or by Pauline Dixon, they're at Newcastle University think tank called the E.G. West Center. They actually have gone around, studied all around the world in developing countries. How are kids being educated? And by and large, more of them are being educated by private than by public schools. And you'd think, how in these developing countries can parents afford to pay tuition for a private school? The answer is they're very low-cost private schools. And this is almost an unknown story until these researchers went out and found it. So most of these kids are being educated privately. They're being educated less expensively than in the government schools, and they get better results. Now, that nobody knows that. So that's how we're always on the defensive, because everybody just what most people have in their minds is a cartoon, or they have in their minds what their own limited imaginations can conjure up. They just think, well, if there's no real profit in catering to poor people, so therefore nobody will. And so they can't think beyond it. And therefore they just think, well, I've thought about it for 30 seconds. I can't see how it would work. Therefore,
forget it.
Yeah. And so what I'm saying is, well, who am I supposed to believe? Your 30 seconds of analysis or my own eyes looking all over the world?
Yeah. Wow. That's true. What do you think of the Betsy DeVos lady that Trump put in? Is she still around? Did they kick her out? Yeah, I don't think so. She seems to be doing okay.
She's around now. She's kind of not totally my kind of person, because I generally don't favor the school voucher approach, because I feel like that's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
How do you mean?
Because if we want to help people be able to afford other forms of education, the best way to do that to the extent possible is with tax credits. Just give them their money back. But this idea that we're going to give you this check of government money and you can spend it at an approved, wink, wink, approved school. Well, gee, what are those going to look like? Exactly like the ones you're trying to run away from. Or would you be able to get away with teaching the things you want to teach if you have to constantly be looking over your shoulder at some bureaucrat who, by the way, has no moral authority over you, given the rotten system they run, where you don't even feel physically safe where they are, you know, their schools half the time. And also, I feel like basically what a lot of young and hardworking parents are working toward and what they're pouring their blood and sweat into is earning enough money so they can live in a decent neighborhood to send their kids to decent schools. So their kids won't have to be, frankly, in schools full of troublemakers, at schools where the kids are going to terrorize them all day. And I think of my own kids. I have sweet, naive kids, and they would be just ground up and spit out by those sorts of systems. So why would I favor a system that says, all right, at least I'm carving out some kind of consumer responsive system. At least I have a system where I can go to a neighborhood and I can kind of pick that way and find at least some kind of school that I like. But then now say, well, look, everybody, you can get a voucher and come on into my school. No. I just fled from these people. You know, I fled from the dysfunctional neighborhoods that I worked my tail off to get out of. Maybe I grew up in those neighborhoods and I said, my gosh, these neighborhoods are full of crazy people. I can't wait to get out of here. And then they follow me. So I'm not a big fan of that. But there's a woman named, I think her name is Candace Jackson. And she is in I forget what her exact title is in the Department of Education. She was appointed by this new secretary. And she is a hardcore Murray Rothbardian who studied at the Mises Institute. And when that was discovered, the media went absolutely berserk. And I thought, you know, if I get nothing else out of these 4 years, I can at least point to this woman.
So what do you think of this whole Trump thing? I think obviously Hillary was the crowd unfavorite, you know, the bottom of the barrel as bad as it could get. So that allowed Trump to come in. But I think a lot of people viewed him as, oh, racism or something. But I think that he indicated to me a rebel spirit in the United States, that people right. were not voting pro-Trump. They were voting anti-government, up your butt-ism. What do you think has been the result? Because I think it's been a little bit of a mixed bag. This tax plan supposedly looks good, but the Syria situation, not so much. The saber rattling with North Korea. I mean, what's your take on this administration so far? And how valid do you think the administration is? Because when 2012, when Ron Paul lost, I figured, forget all these people. And I just gave right. up on politics altogether. Right. So I know it's like a bunch of questions, but if you can maybe speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, I followed Trump with some interest because I liked some of the things he had to say. And I liked the fact that he was, even though he would say crazy things from time to time, that was in a way part of his appeal because he was unrehearsed. I mean, think of Ron Paul. Obviously, he's not the same thing as Donald Trump, but he was unrehearsed. When he would go into these debates, now maybe he could should have been a little bit more rehearsed, but the point is you might as well, you want to be at your best, but the thing is he was sincere and spontaneous in his answers in the debates. Well, for Trump, it was quite clear he had not rehearsed those answers. If he had rehearsed those answers, then the people who gave them to him should have been fired. But it was that it was refreshing that he didn't seem plastic. Whereas Ted Cruz had these, you know, he'd have these pauses that were just a little too long and annoying. And they were obviously fake. And he had obviously done them in front of the mirror 25 times. And, you know, and he got some support, but I think some people thought, you know, I think I've had enough of these slick, you know, hair people with the rehearsed speeches and everything. So I was interested in that, especially because he went to South Carolina and said, they lied to us about the Iraq War. And there are people who all they could do was say negative things about Trump. And I get his negatives, but come on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was saying a lot of things that I couldn't even. He said fake news. That alone was awesome.
That was awesome. That was
great. And him loving, what's his, Julian Assange. He was into him now, not as much apparently.
Not as much.
But
right.
He should be.
Anything that demystifies the national media, that has to be a part of the revolution, let's say. So if that's getting done, as long as it's getting done, Jeb Bush is destroyed forever. That was an accomplishment. I'll take that. But the problem is people voted for Trump and they got Jeb anyway. That's just it. I mean, okay, Jeb wouldn't have done a few of these things, but Jeb probably would have passed the same health care bill. He wouldn't have handled North Korea exactly the same, but he'd be doing something in Syria. He'd be beefing up the American presence in different places the way Trump is. So the fact that John McCain and Lindsey Graham are cheering for Trump, I've been tweeting out, look, if they're cheering for you, that's a pretty good sign something's gone wrong, like you've gone off the rails. And then to be told that the reason he went into Syria was because he saw some sad pictures on television is not reassuring. And I don't mean to make light of the terrible deaths that these people no doubt endured, but that people are enduring terrible deaths constantly and at all times around the world. Think of how many people were beheaded in Saudi Arabia last year. It's a comparable number. And I bet that would make for pretty gut-wrenching television. So I don't buy the whole, I saw a tear-jerking thing on television, therefore we have to go bomb. So very disappointing. And then to have him walk back so many of his statements. I mean, I don't care that he walks back some of them because they were wrong, but for him to all of a sudden say, oh, no, NATO has a great role to play, or
terrible.
But then when you go back and look, you realize that even on the campaign trail, he was sometimes a little bit at odds with himself. Like he would say, on the one hand, the Federal Reserve is blowing up a financial bubble. And then on the other hand, he would say, I really support the low interest rate policy. But you see, the low interest rate policy is what blows up the bubble. So it's and then to have him say, I think Janet Yellen's doing a pretty good job, when on the campaign trail, he said he probably wouldn't reappoint her. It's like when you walk over that threshold into the White House, it's like zombies eat a part of your brain or something. It's weird.
But do you think it's the deep state, or do you think that he was truly unprepared and overly arrogant in his, like, is he crazy like a fox, or has he been compromised? I mean, is there anything genuine left in this campaign, or do you think it was BS?
It's hard to know. And I don't even think it's the case that he was tricking people. I think that I don't think he has a super well thought out, sophisticated philosophy or anything. And I think that now that he's under these tremendous pressures, I mean, I don't think there's been any president where the media has been so adversarial and
so
all these
mean to him. They're terrible to him.
Well, and these all these accusations about Russian influence, like they're terrified of the prospect that we might have some kind of rapprochement with the Russians. Like that's the worst thing we could. Well, they don't have to worry about that now because you know, that's kind of gone in the can too. I mean, of all the things to criticize Trump for, as Scott Horton says, why would you pick out like one of the best things about him, which was that he wanted to try to thaw relations with Russia? You don't criticize him for that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, that's okay. Good. No fighting. Exactly. Chill out.
So who's to know? I mean, who can really know what behind the scenes if he was told what's what or whatever, or if he just felt like, because I kind of feel like Pope Benedict XVI, when he resigned as Pope, which is almost unprecedented, I felt, although there's a lot of speculation as to why that happened, but one very plausible theory is that he was in his 80s and he came to the conclusion that I'm up against so many enemies, I can't accomplish anything and there's no point in trying and I'm old and that's it. And it could be a similar thing. I mean, obviously Trump is more vigorous, but it could be a thing where he came to the conclusion that I literally cannot do anything at this point because the enemies are so great, even within my own party. They're so great. I cannot do anything. So I am just going to have to morph into a conventional Republican who from time to time does unorthodox things. I don't believe that this is, quote, 4D chess. This is just an embarrassing theory, I think, that this is the sort of thing that's trotted out whenever people have a hero they can't let go of. They can't just say the hero made a mistake. It's always, oh, no, he knows things you and I don't. And so he's got some real strategy. He did this terrible thing because he's secretly hoping to. I think that's too clever by half. I don't see any reason to believe that.
Yeah, I think that people, they love their heroes. I mean, everybody worships Ron Paul, but you know, in retrospect, there are some things that could have been done differently.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, and that's a great example, Tatiana, because people would say during the Ron Paul campaign, there would be. I mean, obviously, you can love Ron as I genuinely do. I mean,
who doesn't love Ron Paul?
I mean, I worked my tail off for that cause. Totally. You know? So I love that guy, but that doesn't mean you can't think that maybe a staffer made a bad decision. Could of all people, Ron Paul would be the last person who would say to us, you must never question what my subordinates do. Could you imagine? What is this, Joseph Stalin? He would never have done that. So, but there would be people during the campaign who, instead of saying, yeah, you know, the staff really is making a strategic error, instead it was, oh no, this is actually a brilliant move. And you, Woods, are too naive to understand the ways of the world and whatever. You know, go jump in a lake. I don't buy any of this.
Yeah, well, I think I think the healthy criticism is good. And I'll say this, you know, I've never been a huge Ann Coulter fan or anything. I remember seeing her at one ISFLC and whining that it was awful. But she wrote a really great piece in Breitbart criticizing Trump, saying, you know, we want the president back that we voted for. And it was nice to see the pushback from his hardcore base, you know, sort of the kind of right wingers or whatever, their own faction. I don't want to label them alt-right because I don't think it's a fair categorization for everybody. I think it has a negative connotation. I don't think that everybody on the alt-right is horrible. But in this case, I was happy to see the pushback because, and now I wonder who's left, right? Because the anti-war faction is supposedly the left, but they're super pro-war. Look at CNN and their little cohorts. But the right is now pro-war. So it's like, where did the peaceniks go?
And so that's why I have friends who say if Hillary had been elected, you'd still have these anti-war right-wing people. But now that it's a Republican, well, now they're gung-ho for it. And the thing is, I think most of his hardcore voters are still with him because most of them can't make, they don't know that it's bad that a Paul Ryan of all people influenced healthcare bill is a bad idea. Like they just think Obamacare bad. So I think a lot of them are not going to see the depths of the problems until he really, really turns on them. But in terms of like the thinkers at the top of the movement, it has been encouraging to see an Ann Coulter stand up and Nigel Farage in Britain stand up and say this is a big mistake and he shouldn't do it. Two things I would say about that. First of all, this is certainly better than we saw among most Obama supporters, because most of them, now there were certainly exceptions and they were very honorable, but by and large, when Obama would do something terrible on foreign policy, they would either ignore it, make excuses for it, hold their noses, whatever. You didn't see this kind of backlash against Obama that we see against Trump. So that is, you know, I don't know what that says, but it's something. But the other thing is, as long as we're talking about Ann Coulter, man, what a mistake she made backing out of speaking in Berkeley. She should have gone ahead and done it. Regardless of whether her sponsors were still behind her, she should have said, this is going to bring the crazies out like nothing ever before seen, and that will be good for the cause of civilization and sanity in this country, for people to see what these people are really about, who they are, what their intentions are, and what's coming to a neighborhood near you. She could have performed that service, and instead she backed down, and that was just a major mistake.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really pay that much attention to the story, but as you explained the take on it, that does sound pretty wild. It's crazy how, I don't know, I mean, I performed at this Deplora Ball down in D.C., and I was very concerned because everybody says Milo's so terrible. And I don't know, I mean, I watch him, some things are kind of offensive. Maybe because I'm from Jersey, we don't get so easily offended.
Right.
But the rabid insanity of the protesters is so much more disturbing to me than anything that Milo could ever say or any of these people who I think are kind of just being ridiculous and funny in a way to, or almost provocative on purpose to point out the hypocrisy. But it's very disappointing. But how do people, I have a song, The Same Side, right? I want us all to kind of join together with such animosity. Where is the sanity to be found? How do libertarians reach out to not only people on the right, but also to people on the left? Like, what is the solution when the Antifa people are going bananas and causing so many problems?
Yeah, those people, I would say, there's no point in trying to reach out to them. But I mean, my view is you ask yourself, what's my strength? Who are the people I can most easily identify with?
Low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, low-hanging fruit. So I think of my own background. Now, I, like a lot of people who listen to me, come from a more right-leaning background, but I have a lot of people, because I hear from them every day, who came from a more left-leaning background, and they say, you know, look, I had the same sort of experience you did just from the left, and I suddenly realized the things I had been taught to believe were just not, something wasn't quite right about them. And you know, we all go through that moment of saying, aha, I now have to look at the world a different way. So I wouldn't say there's any one approach. Rather, just think about, because there are some of us who were just born libertarian. I certainly was not. Those people, I don't know what your assignment is. Go read a book or something. I don't know what your assignment is. But for all of those of us who converted from something else, go back and find some of those people, you know, that you knew when you were in those days, and try and engage them, and just try and see what works, and find low hanging fruit issues, because certainly you can agree that we should be cutting the budget a bit more, and we can agree on the following five things, and then just ask, how does it seem to be working out? No matter which person we vote for, the system seems to roll along pretty much unchanged. What does that tell you about the whole system? Maybe you should think differently. You know, see where that takes you. Or if you just can't help yourself, you get behind a microphone and you start a podcast and you talk to people that way. And that's been working for me. I have so many people who say, oh, Woods, you're just preaching to the choir. But even if that were true, my choir is a really proselytizing choir. They bring my episodes to the great unwashed, who then listen to them and say, hey, this is some pretty good stuff. So the choir carries the message to the other people, to the people who are loitering outside the church. And I've brought a lot of those people in without even really trying, just saying what I believe and being sincere and being as informed as I can be. And believe it or not, that seems to work.
Yeah, well, I know. I guess it just starts to feel a little bit overwhelming sometimes. I had this guest on a couple last week named Ryan Dawson, and he does a lot of foreign policy stuff, and he's really great with that. And what he was saying was, you know, instead of people fighting on Facebook, is just do a phone bank and call your representative or go down there and talk to them about your issues, because there are people too, and they're getting bombarded by pro-war this, pro-war that, and they're not hearing the opposing voice. And it was a simple exercise where, you know, each of your friends, everybody calls 15-minute slots, whatever. And it was such a simple thing. it made me feel a little bit better about how to approach this. If you had another tip besides podcasting, what would be the best way to kind of bring people into the fold and spread the message? Like, have you seen any techniques that are working or anything that you're kind of excited about in terms of activism that you think is effective?
Well, what I like is that I'm seeing now people who do things other than just blogging and arguing on Facebook, which I have done plenty of, and there's nothing wrong with that. And we need people blogging, and we certainly need people on Facebook doing stuff. Just don't waste too much of your time, because it's, you know, it's...
Well, it's a purposeful echo chamber that's manipulated. That's the problem with Facebook.
Right.
But yes.
Right.
Social media in general.
But what I've seen is actually people just thinking, well, here's what I do, or here's, let's say, a talent that I have, and how can I turn it to the good of this? And so I've seen now... several stand-up comedians who I know for a fact are libertarians, and they, in their own way, get the message out. Or, you know, the musicians like you, for example. You write great music, but you also, you know...
Give it to the man, right, with a little subversion.
That's right. And another example of that is this, maybe you're familiar with this band Backwards. They're a metal rap band headed up by Eric July.
Yeah,
they are about as blunt as you can possibly be. I mean, they have a song on individualism. They have a song on praxeology. I mean, this is a little bit technical. They have a song called "Utopias Don't Exist." If you look at their album, it's very, very blunt. But they're going after a demographic that we are at risk of losing. Like, we had that younger group when we had Ron Paul, and now we don't have Ron Paul. And for whatever merits Rand has, he hasn't connected with that young audience the way his father did. So, I mean, basically the short answer is just look at what it is that you are knowledgeable about or can do, and then think, is there any way I can put this to the service of the things I believe in? And so that's what I see bearing a lot of the fruit these days.
Yeah. And I think also fostering community. One of the things that I really liked about going on the Contra Cruise last year was the sense of everybody sort of building up a relationship and almost getting that sense of family. And you know, I've seen everybody carrying on those relationships, you know, through social media and stuff like that. This coming year, people are going to be going again. Can you tell us a little bit about Contra Cruise?
Yeah, Bob Murphy, who's an economist you've spoken to on the show before, Bob. Have you not?
Bob is a really good friend of mine. We've done an Economics 101 episode too, which was
good.
Really fun.
Good. Okay. Well, I know you guys have known each other for a while. And so, of course, you were a natural choice. We wanted to have you as a musician aboard the cruise. Bob and I actually host a weekly podcast on top of the daily one that I do. And it's called Contra Krugman. And we take one of Paul Krugman's two New York Times columns for the week and we critique it. And we look for the errors and we overturn them. But more than that, we just have fun doing it. Like, we're joking around, we're taking jabs at each other. And then we try and make really awkward segues into promoting the cruise on the episode. So somebody will, you know, will say something like, yeah, you know, he had to, so-and-so worked really hard on that. And then we'll say, you know where you won't have to work hard is aboard the Contra Cruise. So we decided, well, you know, what the heck? If National Review, Bill Buckley's old magazine, if they can have, I think, two cruises a year, we can have a cruise. Why can't we do that?
Oh, yeah. I love the cruise idea. It was so fun.
Yeah, so I approached one of these cruise companies, and I said, I think we can bring X number of people, and here's what we'd want to do. So, yeah, we give a couple of talks, but we had fun. I mean, we did Pictionary with libertarian topics. We did Family Feud with libertarian questions. And I had genuinely surveyed 100 people, just like in the real show.
Really?
My Twitter feed, I'd surveyed 100 people. We compiled the answers. And they were just, it was so funny. People just had nonstop fun. We rotated tables at dinner every night. So people would get to sit with different people, sit with Bob, sit with me and each other. And it just was nonstop fun. In fact, it was so great. Bob and I would have like a little meeting at the end of each day just to go over how it was going. And I remember one of those, we looked at each other and said, this is going so well. It's like better than any of the books we've ever written. Like, this is the best thing we've ever done. By a mile, this is the best thing we've ever done. So we are definitely doing a second one. You can find out about it at ContraCruise.com. What's funny, at ContraCruise.com, we have a 4-minute video montage from the first cruise that we did. Have you had a chance to see that video? Because you're in it.
Yes. Yeah. No. Definitely.
It is a great. It really gives you a good, as well as 4 minutes can, a good sense of what it's going to be like. Notice how I say, I don't say what it would be like. what it's going to be like when you are on, when you are aboard the Contra Cruise with us later this year. It is, we're calling it the Libertarian Event of the Year. It's just fun. And we actually had people on that cruise who told us, I had actually not been aware of this, who said they had never met another libertarian in person before in their entire lives until they were on that cruise.
I think you need to make an outreach to more singles, though. That was the only thing last year. It was all couples. You know, all right. And you know what was funny was that the women were dragging the men. It wasn't like, oh, what happened? Your husband brought you, your boyfriend brought you. They're like, nope, I brought him. There was this one lady. She was a good dancer. I liked her.
Well, we were very pleasantly surprised about that aspect of things, that really there was no either male or female dragged spouse syndrome. Everybody really was very engaged.
I agree. Everybody was really happy to be there. Do you have any other people coming besides you and Bob and me and the band, I guess?
For special guests, we are going to have this year Scott Horton, who I mentioned several times before, who is the libertarian authority on foreign policy. Yeah, we're going to have you must have met at some time or another Michael Bolden, the 10th Amendment Center.
Yes, Michael's a really fun person, too.
That's why I invited him. Not even. Yeah. 10th Amendment. That's great. I invited him because he's so fun to hang around with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So
I hung out with Scott too. I think he was going to be at Porkfest or one of these crazy events. So that'll be a reunion.
And then for musical entertainment, we're adding Jordan Page into the mix.
Yeah, that's going to be great. He and I hopefully we're trying to coordinate Porkfest right now, getting the band back together. So
that's going to be great. Well, I'll tell you, when the first cruise went on, he contacted me and I said, you know, let's wait and see if this one is a bust or is successful or not. Because I mean, he's leaving six kids when he comes. And I needed to make sure this was going to be a going concern first. And then when it was a success, I called him up and said, okay, why do you think I'm calling?
Yeah.
Just invite him on this thing.
Cool. Yes. Well, I'll be happy to have him there. And yeah, it's going to be fun. So, is it affordable for people? How do people do it? Can they go forward to a room and make it a little cheaper? Cause cruises can be a little expensive.
Yeah, they are. I mean, of course, obviously, if you bring somebody and you don't have to, because there's a premium that's paid if you get your own room. But if you share a room with somebody, you can knock a little dough off. But, you know, I think when you consider you're getting seven solid days of basically, first of all, eating all the food you can possibly eat.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
Oh, yeah. And then just entertainment and fun all day long. And then our package includes a lot of the stuff that normally gets tacked on at the end and you're surprised. Like at the end of a cruise, normally you get this big bill for gratuities for the week. Mm-hmm. We already include that, or port charge.
Oh, that's good.
That stuff is in there. So literally, once you sign up, you don't pay another cent. You walk off that thing, not another cent.
Awesome. Well, that's really good. I'm excited. I can't wait. What are the dates for the cruise again?
October 15th through the 22nd of 2017, contracruise.com is the website for that. And then in general, for me, tomsfreebooks.com is where I have some libertarian ebooks that I put together basically to help people win debates, like to give you really good ammunition. And you can just download them.
Check that out.
Yeah, it's just Tom's.
Do you have them in audiobooks or just readable books?
I don't have them in audiobooks, but on the other hand, I do have the 900 podcast episodes, so you can always...
Oh, you and your 900 podcasts. It's just not enough, Tom.
You know what? You've created a monster, because now when I get to 1,000, you're never going to hear the end of it. You're never... It's just going to be my 1,000 episodes. Well, it's going to be... I'm not going to be able to stand myself when it gets to that point.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing them. I've learned a lot from them over the years, and it's nice to send my mom and dad stuff. Although they're pretty libertarian themselves. I was lucky that they didn't indoctrinate me with any kind of left or right. They were both just like government thumbs down.
Nice. Good for you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Tom, for coming on the show. I look forward to the Contra Krugman cruise and, you know, the 1,000th episode. And of course, everybody check out libertyclassroom.com. I think it's really cool. They've got a new app. Any final words, Tom?
Nothing other than thank you for being Tatiana Moroz and coming on our cruise the second year in a row. And it's been a lot of fun together, hasn't it?
Oh yeah.
Every time our paths cross, it's always for something awesome and great. and exciting and thrilling. And I hope that never ends.
Yeah, there's some, you know, there are some low points when you're fighting for freedom, but there are a whole lot of high points where you make a lot of good friendships. And
by the way, can I just say,
sense of purpose.
As one parting thing, that even if our events were nothing other than preaching to the choir, you know, we do from time to time need to have our optimism and our camaraderie strengthened. You know,
absolutely.
That's very important. That's not a small thing.
I agree. Yeah, we got to fight the power and we've got to feel like family. So,
right.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for watching the show. Thank you to CryptoCompare.com and to BitcoinCPA.com and all of our other sponsors, especially go check out FreeRoss.org, my site, TatianaMorose.com, where you can buy the brand new record, Keep the Faith, and CryptoMediaHub.com if you want to learn more about Bitcoin stuff. Thanks again, Tom, and we'll see you all next week. Peace out.
All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, I am on my own. I'm doing a little episode by myself on an interesting topic, and I'm just going to leave it at that. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.